Hi, I'm Christy Lee, the creator of Canadian True Crime. Join me for an immersive deep dive into some of the most thought-provoking true crime cases in Canada. Using facts curated from court documents, inquiry reports, and news archives, I carefully unravel and analyze each case, exposing the pitfalls of the criminal justice system that everyone needs to know about. Find Canadian True Crime wherever you listen to podcasts or visit CanadianTrueCrime.ca.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
For the first time this morning, motorists traveling the Island Highway through Nanoose Bay could have seen the billboards for two missing and possibly murdered women from Vancouver Island, Lisa Young and Angeline Peet.
A giant billboard with Lisa's picture is now up on the island. Lisa's friends are fighting to keep her memory alive and her case active. They have been pushing for answers for almost two decades.
Where is Lisa?
15 years gone, and Lisa Marie Young's loved ones continue to ask the same question.
Where is Lisa?
The 21-year-old brunette vanished on June 30th, 2002, after leaving a party.
Lisa's mom, Joanne, organized a march for Lisa every year.
Joanne Young never sought out the media spotlight, but that's where she found herself time and again as she tried to make sure the search for her missing daughter, Lisa Young, never faded from the public eye. On this day, she was feeling positive because the federal government had just announced a national inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women.
It's about time, and I'm really hopeful that Trudeau will follow through.
That was Joanne Young's last interview with Czech News.
And when Joanne dies, Lisa's family and friends carry on the yearly walks.
Under gray Nanaimo skies, 16 years to the day that Lisa Marie Young vanished from this community, her family and friends are gathered to march and find justice for her.
Her life stopped in that moment. Her family and friends, they stopped in that moment.
And there is increased interest in Lisa's story, as cases of murdered and missing Indigenous women are the subject of a national inquiry.
Families of 29 murdered and missing women have traveled to this Port Alberni gymnasium from across the West Coast to share for the record what happened to their mothers, sisters, and daughters, and the lasting impact it's having on those left behind.
I have to think those responsible for what happened to Lisa are paying attention. Lisa's story isn't fading away. I'm Laura Palmer. This is season one of Island Crime, Where is Lisa? This is episode five, A Tipster and an Outside Investigator. British Columbia, Canada has the highest number of missing adult reports in the country. The vast majority are resolved within a week, but Lisa is still missing. Here is the official word on Lisa Marie Young's disappearance as it appears on the RCMP's national website for Canada's missing persons in 2018. Lisa Marie Young was last seen in the early morning hours of June 30th, 2002. She went to a local bar and met some male acquaintances after the bar closed. She and her acquaintances accepted a ride from another man whom they had just met. Lisa Marie was last seen with the man in the vehicle, heading to get some food. Her friends and family have not heard from her since, which is completely out of character. The billboards and the attention to Lisa's case online are working. People are still surfacing with information. David is one of those people. And a warning, the information David tells me is disturbing.
The next recovering addict, I've been cleaning up for 10 years. I've been in prison half my life, completed that parole. I was married. I was a professional prize fighter. I was the gangster again. And I was involved with serious people and doing bad stuff, you know, and that's all I knew. That's all I knew, right? And anyways, I have my last prison sentence was 2002. I'm a born-again Christian also. This is all God's doing, I'm telling you. And I haven't been in prison. I don't live that lifestyle. I don't do drugs. I'm a new personality. So it's been haunting me. And this is one that's been haunting me for years.
I do want to hear, you know, how you're doing now, because it sounds like you've got a different and maybe more positive life now.
Yeah, I'm a competitive bodybuilder now. I'm a champion bodybuilder, amateur bodybuilder. I just competed in Mr. Canada and Quebec Laval last year. I'm going to be 60 next year. I was in the 55 Grandmasters, 55 years and over. I mean, I live on a farm. I live with family members. I raise goats and cat, and that's what I do. That's my life.
So you have this new life, and it sounds like things are going well. What is it that's weighing on your mind?
It's always been weighing on my mind. And I've been, now I just came out of the Stone Age. I was illiterate for the age of 26, and I just got on the computer not long ago. My family, got me on the computer, showed me how to work it, blah blah blah. Anyway, any odd time you see something about in memory of Lisa, people, if you know anything, and just, yeah, I know. I've been trying to get hold of myself, right? So one day, okay, I prayed to God. I said, God, if you want me to do this, let's do this. It has a way, once in a while, I tell you what I know.
Yeah.
You will understand how this has been haunting me.
What is it you know, and how do you know it?
I used to hang out with and we were gangsters. We did crimes together and violence together. Okay. So. One day it started like this. I'm in the back seat of a car. She was driving, and there was a girl called Amber. The police will know her. And by my feet, in the back seat, there was two video cassette taping things, just cassette tapes. And then they were talking, saying about this guy, Rob. This guy, and I'm not catching this. I don't even know what's going on. They're saying, these tapes are on the floor. Anybody could have picked them up. Everyone would have got busted, la, la, la. I said, holy fuck, that's pretty stupid. He says, yeah. He says, I can't believe this guy. Anyways, and Amber said to Mike, okay, we'll deal with this. Oh, okay. And that was the last I'd heard about him. But I didn't know what this tape was in, anything about it, nothing. All right. About 2 months later, I'm a drug dealer now. It happened about Lisa Marie gone missing, and this girl who used to buy drugs for me, I don't remember her name, and her boyfriend name was Rob. Now, this is how this tape's getting, how this comes in contact. This girl comes to me in fear for her life, telling me about what happened. And she said, I said, what are you talking about? Why are you so fearful? What happened? She goes, I think the is going to kill me because of what I know and what down on my place. I said, what happened? They had Lisa Marie at her house. And they're supposed to be doing a porno movie, like a snuff movie, but it was like to be like a bullshit one, not actually a real one. It was like a mock one. Went sour. Supposedly went sour, and she got murdered. And then they took the body and they dropped it into the well. Rob, eventually, I grabbed Rob and I said, Rob, your girl's telling me this. What's going on here, buddy? And he owns up to it. And he's telling me he's also fearful. He tells her what happened. And he says the same thing that she said.
Did you just say that they said they put Lisa's body down a well?
Yes, and they moved her body afterward because they were fearful that, in case one of them talked or something. There's a few people involved in this, and I what gets me is, usually you get a lot of people, people talk, like you already had this girl, so when the links are already starting to, like a weak link, that's saying the weak links. You already have two weak links. And I was surprised how this ship is staying afloat and nobody has talking in between them. He has boasts about this. the people. It's really hot. Yeah. He truly has boasted. Now, I wouldn't go for, I don't know as far as boasting. He says it, eating his conscience, like when he's talking to the girl there, right? To me, that's boasting. Because once you kill somebody, you don't want nobody to know your business. You know what I mean? And everybody in Nanaimo has a, you know, a good understanding of who or who the plans are this, you know? And if what I have to say, God, I hope it comes to good for these police and they charge them, I will come to court. I have no fear at all to testify.
Over the years, Lisa's parents, Don and Joanne, would get calls from people like David, claiming to have information about Lisa. I can't imagine what it would be like to hear those stories over and over and over again. I'm not in a position to verify what David has told me. There is no second source. But I found David. He didn't seek me out. Some of what he says sounds fantastic, but I have been able to confirm elements of his background. He was indeed a bad guy. I checked his criminal record. And he is a champion bodybuilder. I found stories of his wins. Many of the names of people connected with Lisa's disappearance have a background as prize fighters, boxers, and bodybuilders. As I listen to David and try to assess his credibility, I'm reminded of another phone conversation I had many years ago. I interviewed Robert Picton over the phone in the late 1990s, very early in my journalism career. The story was about taxes. Back then, Picton was simply a pig farmer, raising concerns about taxes on agricultural land. This was a few years before his arrest, at a time when he was in the midst of his serial killing spree. Picton would go on to be known as Canada's very worst serial killer. After his arrest, I found the contact information I had put into our database. I'd simply noted that Picton was a good talker. That's media slang for someone who can successfully string a few words together if you put a mic in front of them. I think of that conversation as I speak with people about Lisa Marie's disappearance. I'd like to think my judgment is better than it was back then, honed over more than 25 years and thousands of interviews. And yet, Lisa's story is tricky terrain. It's an open investigation. Lisa is still missing. A number of people I've spoken to on and off the record express fear. I'm doing my best to present information that is truthful, but I'm wary of being played. In the last episode, we talked about how time really is not on our side in this case. Dallas Hulley, Lisa's friend and one of the last people to see her alive, is now dead. Run over at the side of the road. Lisa's mom, Joanne, a woman who carried on her own investigation and campaign for justice, has passed as well. Just after I interviewed David, I learned from him that one of the characters he talked about, one of the brothers linked to Lisa's disappearance, has now died too. And so I'm anxious for answers now. I'm eager to speak with someone who can bring an investigative perspective to Lisa's case. I reach out to local private detectives. One agrees to act as an informal soundboard for my questions for background only, and I take him up on this offer. And I seek out others with relevant experience. Recalling my interview with Robert Picton reminds me that a leading authority on missing women investigations is right here on my doorstep. Laura Mershenner wrote a book about his experience on the Picton case. It's called Lonely Section of Hell, The Botched Investigation of a Serial Killer Who Almost Got Away. No longer a police officer, he agrees to speak with me about Lisa Marie's case from his home in Vancouver. And an apology. The quality of this audio isn't great.
My name is Laura Mershenner. I'm a retired 27-year Vancouver police officer. I was a detective for 21 of those years. And my biggest, I guess, detective duties were around Vancouver's missing women. And yeah, I worked on that case. My first week there, I got a tip on Robert Picton, who ended up being convicted of murdering six of our women. And I suppose really through that work, I think I became very painfully aware of the inadequacies of a lot of police investigations around missing people, and specifically missing women, and more specifically missing marginalized women, because I started to see that they definitely received a different level of service. And I think part of it was not so much because they were just dismissed out of hand, but that there were a lot of stereotypes that investigators held about people living in those kinds of circumstances, and those stereotypes really got in the way of a robust investigation.
I briefly describe the facts of the case and ask Lorimer to place himself back in that time as he considers what happens next. I begin by asking if the police behavior after Lisa's parents first reported her missing seems normal.
But it wasn't, because I would submit that if it were a middle-class white girl, there would have been a lot more concern. And only because those detectives would have formed the thoughts that was unusual for her. Whereas with a young Indigenous woman as their victim, when, you know, the missing person, in their minds, they're thinking, maybe she's a drug user, maybe she's a drinker. We already know the circumstances. She's out partying or sort of in social situations. And they would make all these little finely tuned decisions about who she was and about her life that they would not even be conscious of. It would make them say, yeah, we can wait 4 days before we really jump on this. And they wouldn't do that, I would submit, with a white, young white woman. It's normal, but it's not normal. It shouldn't be the way that they're handled, but often I think it's the normal progression of this victim stereotyping that you see happening. And so they're sort of almost like lower priority missing person cases because they think there are aspects of that person's life that makes their disappearance a little less valid, makes them think that they're not, quote unquote, really missing, which I heard a million times in my investigation. Well, is she really missing? Because there'd be, again, these stereotypes, these stereotypical ideas that, women in the downtown east side or Indigenous women who maybe like to go out with their friends a lot and maybe have a few drinks, but somehow they don't want it found. Just some kind of a little bender that he's going to return from. And that often, leads to pretty bad consequences.
Hi, I'm Christy Lee, the creator of Canadian True Crime. Join me for an immersive deep dive into some of the most thought-provoking true crime cases in Canada. Using facts curated from court documents, inquiry reports, and news archives, I carefully unravel and analyze each case, exposing the pitfalls of the criminal justice system that everyone needs to know about. Find Canadian True Crime wherever you listen to podcasts or visit canadiantruecrime.ca.
Joanne, that's Lisa's mom, was, so worried that people would, that the police specifically would not pay as much attention or worse, or assume that Lisa Marie was a prostitute, that really she tried to downplay Lisa Marie's Indigenous background. I can't imagine a mom having to think about that when she's talking to police.
No, that would be absolutely common practice among Indigenous mothers reporting their daughters. I've heard it time and time and time and time again. When talking with them, they know full well, and it's not just, it's a little bit anecdotal among them when they're talking to each other, but they know full well. It's the same way, when Black people are talking about how to interact with the police, if they get stopped by the police, and just, this is what you need to do to be safe. And I think for Indigenous moms, this is what they need to do in order for their, hopefully, to get their daughter's cases taken a little bit more seriously. Yeah, it's absolutely true. And it's horrifying when you, I think the National Inquiry is a good example. Like, when you look at some of the details of those stories, this theme comes up time and time and time again.
The story kind of hits the papers, I'm going to say, about 4 or 5 days after. And in the first story, the police are quoted as saying, they have no reason to suspect foul play. What would make police suspect something had gone wrong? I found it a curious thing to read in that first report. And so like, what would they have had to have heard to make them think something had gone wrong?
Well, you know, I can't speak for them because I can't put myself in that mindset. But me hearing that, for them to say that, it seems ridiculous, because to me, the only thing I would need to hear as that investigator is that she was left spoken to in a car with somebody holding her against her will. And the fact that we haven't found her, and those were her last, you know, interactions with someone who knew her, to me, that's more than enough. I've always worked on the assumption that you rule things out before you do nothing. You have to rule out whether, you know, it's easy, super easy if you investigate it hard and you go at it hard, and sure enough you find that she's hiding out with her boyfriend somewhere and didn't want to be found. Great. Best case scenario, everybody's happy, she's safe. But short of that, you have to assume this is serious. And I think when someone's holding, you got her telling a friend that she's in a car, not being allowed to leave, to me that just screams to circumstances in combination with the fact that she's missing, you know? I don't know what those police would have needed to think it was suspicious, but I personally would not have felt that you'd need anything more than that.
As I begin listening back to my conversation, I think about those early days of the police investigation. And I wonder, when did Dallas Hulley tell the police about the calls he had from Lisa Marie?
Sure enough, it's Lisa on her cell phone. I call her back. She goes, Dallas, I don't know what's going on. This guy won't bring me back. We're sitting in a driveway on Bourne Road, and he won't bring me back. We're just sitting here. She's like, I'm bored. I'm getting pissed off.
Surely, had they have known that next day that she'd called Dallas and said she was uncomfortable and not being let go from the Red Jag, that would have been enough to make them suspect foul play.
You know, now if somebody is missing, you know, it pops up on Facebook and Twitter and what have you. But back then, like, how quickly would the media have been involved? If it was a concern for police, would they involve the media straight away back then?
No. The only time the police would involve the media is if it were what they would consider to be a high profile file, you know, a young child, or maybe an elderly person, someone who they determined at their own estimation was someone vulnerable, you know, quote unquote vulnerable. And they wouldn't, the definition of vulnerability has changed a great deal since that time.
So Lisa's body has never been found, and so she's officially still listed as missing. But no one I've talked to believes she's alive. And in fact, it's quite a peculiar circumstance, well, to my mind, in that so many people I talk to in the community feel quite confident they know exactly what happened. What do you make of the fact that her body was never found? How unusual is that?
Well, it's quite unusual. It's not an easy thing to dispose of a body without it being found. It's really not. And so, you know, it always makes me think that you've either got somebody who's got the luxury of some time to deal with that body, or who's got privacy and space to, you know, in the example of Picton, you know, on his own property, he could, you know, he could do everything he needed to do to dispose of his bodies, because he had a lot of property and it was private. It's quite unusual. And, you know, invariably over time, something usually turns up. Proximity to water makes it a little tougher, because it is a little bit easier, you know, when you live somewhere near the ocean or near a large body of water, you know, there's some other ways you can deal with that. Unfortunately, over time, you know, with decomposition and critters in the water and things like that, it does make it really tough. Part of it is that, you know, you kind of have to know what you're doing, obviously. You know, that was one of the things that we had to do in our investigation, rule out where the women weren't, because we really, you know, weren't having a lot of luck figuring out where they were. It's pretty ominous and pretty suspicious. I mean, this was for that long and there's no contact.
Lisa's mom, Joanne, a few weeks after Lisa has gone missing, is asked to come to Parksville to a lockup there where they have the guy who was last seen with her. And she's asked to bring, you know, pictures of Lisa Marie, some of her belongings. Is that, yeah, like, how common is that? Is that as an approach?
Well, you know, you would eventually use that approach in trying to, you would sort of coordinate that with an effort to try to give the suspect kind of a face-saving way to admit what he did. So you could sort of say, you know, you really didn't mean to kill her, did you? You just, you know, this was just, you know, this is rough sex that went wrong, or this was, you know, you hit her, but you weren't trying to kill her, and she just hit her head. Isn't that what happened? You know, you try to sort of give them these slightly less, you know, offensive alternatives to that they can say, yeah, actually, that was just, that's all. And then, and so that it's just a way in, basically. Again, you know, if just playing armchair quarterback, it makes me think they don't really understand the minds, and nor do I, but enough to know that nobody understands the minds of these guys that do this. And unless, you know, he was somebody who was friends with her or had some sort of intimate connection with her, you know, the likelihood of, you know, playing on his sympathy, I think, is pretty slim. And so it seems, it's obvious if they weren't able to charge him that that was all they had. And I think it's a bit of a Hail Mary, and if you do it, sort of, you certainly tip off to the suspect that you've got nothing else. You know, you've got no other evidence. And then he just walks out and goes, like, you see it.
And again, I know this is not your investigation, and you're looking at this down the years as well. One of the things that certainly is raised by family and friends is that he was a member of a prominent local family. And, you know, he was driving a red Jag and, like, really kind of stood out in the community as somebody well connected. Like,
right.
So, like, really, like, how much would that be taken into consideration?
Probably a lot. You know, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, if it walks like a duck, it walks like a duck, it's probably a duck. And I think this kind of thing happens all the time where, you know, and again, I really go back to the idea of stereotypes, because if this guy then falls into a type in their mind, you know, good family, you know, good, because, you know, they equate good family with a family with money. So they think, oh, yeah, okay, this is a guy with a good family. You know, he's a, you know, whatever, the, you know, a child of prominent people, and, you know, he doesn't fit their idea of a killer, probably. So these all play into the approach that the police take. And so, like I said, in all of this, I think in the investigators' minds, they all think they're doing the right thing and doing a great job. But again, it's all based in these almost like templates, if you will, you know, kind of a stereotype of each player in this little play. And when they have those stereotypes, then it's going to follow a very stereotypical path. None of these investigators walks into this thinking, okay, I'm going to be biased today. I'm going to be racist today. I'm going to be classist today. They don't think, it's not like that. But what happens is they're so, as all of us are, they have all these biases they carry, and we all do. And if you're not even aware that you have them, you're not going to be able to question them or be able to step outside of them for a second and say, am I really looking at this investigation bearing in mind all the biases I have? The problem isn't having the biases. The problem is when you can't acknowledge that you carry them and then look beyond them.
Well, that particular interaction between the police and Lisa Marie's mom, Joanne, also, there's a moment where she was asked to hug this guy.
Again, I can't imagine a universe in which they would make, you know, a Caucasian mother of a Caucasian victim do that. I can't imagine. And they wouldn't think about it. They wouldn't even probably be able to articulate, well, why would you do it with this person, but you know, not with this person? That's unfortunately unsurprising to me that the time that happened, but that was still horrifying.
At any rate, no charges were ever laid. And then, you know, there's a suggestion that there were others involved at these other parties, and that's where you kind of get into speculation, because none of that anyone has ever had firsthand knowledge of.
Can I comment on something about
that,
if it's okay? Because that's really interesting to me too, because I think that really speaks to an inadequacy in the RCMP in their investigation strategy, because the same thing happened with Pictou. It was quite clear pretty early on, after he was arrested and we had wiretap up and lots of stuff was coming out about his involvement. And I had always suspected there were others involved in that too. And I think the RCMP felt like that was possible as well. And then they started to see some indications of that as the case was kind of developing. But there was a point where they made a choice, and I don't know if it was a conscious choice or not, but they decided they were going to just focus on Pictou, and that they were going to try to bring all these potential co-accused, try to bring them on side as witnesses against Pictou. But in doing that, they threatened them all with being charged potentially as co-accused if they didn't cooperate. They said, basically, you need to testify. Tell us everything you know about Pictou, or we're going to charge you too. And almost universally, they all just said to the RCMP, screw you guys, I'm not saying anything, and I go ahead and charge me. You don't have anything on me. And so they knew they had nothing. They all called their bluff. And so ultimately, when the trial came, half of those people didn't even get called to testify in any way, and they didn't get charged with being accessories or being co-accused. And I don't believe the RCMP actually even had the resources to investigate the conspiracy part of that case that I believe actually exists. And so you have to wonder if this isn't the same, where they just decided to focus on, they get this tunnel vision on one guy, and they don't really pay a lot of attention to maybe some of the indicators that there are others involved, or even real people telling them, look, there's other people involved here. It's too complicated for them to be able to manage. So they just don't, they just say, nope, we're just going to go at this guy. And then, if that guy's not your guy, then they have nothing. I think it's not so much they want to blow off a case. I think they actually sometimes just don't know what to do.
The people who believe they know what happened, all seem to say the same thing, which is, there's a party and there's some very bad people at that party, guys who have lengthy criminal records to particular brothers. A part of me just wants to believe it's simply that there was never a body found, and that it's just been impossible to charge anybody without the body. But I don't know.
Because that was 2002, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, even 99, 2000, one of the VPD homicide detectives was actually able to get a conviction on a gang case where they never had a body. And just through DNA, right? And it was starting to become possible then, this whole notion that I had bumped up against a lot, no body, no crime, was starting to change. It was starting to slowly change.
Speaking with the families and the friends, they're all so reluctant to openly criticize the police. If you're not satisfied with an investigation, what do you do?
And this has always been my frustration, is that there's no policy that says, do your damn job, or apply, the same rigor to your job for everybody.
Virtually every person I've talked to in Nanaimo, they all say the same story, and they all believe it.
That is so familiar. I have to tell you, my book came out in 2015, and so I've been toured with it. I still speak quite a bit about it, and almost everywhere I've spoken about it publicly someone's always come up to me and has had some connection with Bunker Quilt or some connection with that farm. And they've said, you know, I knew somebody who used to live there, or I used to live there, I grew up there, and yada yada. They've all had some little tidbit to tell me that helps to confirm some of my theories around some of the things that were going on out there that never saw the light of day. And I suspect, I mean, your case sounds exactly like it.
Lorimer Shenner is right. There are people on the island who know something. It just takes one of them to come forward and do the right thing. I think about Lisa's father, Don. He's in his 60s, caring for an adult son, his arthritis making it uncomfortable for him to walk, hoping to retire, considering a move. I think about Lisa's grandparents. They have all waited too long for answers. Ahead in episode 6, the former white-collar crime fighter who has taken a special interest in Lisa's case.
I know who the killers are. I know who was involved. And numerous people, many others in Nanaimo, know who's involved and who took Lisa from them, yet nothing has happened. And you know, to a normal citizen, you kind of think, well, of course, you know, you can't get away with murder, but you can get away, and people do get away with murder. And in this case, they are getting away with murder.
I'm Laura Palmer, and this is Island Crime, Season 1. Where is Lisa?
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.